share with us her experience here and with the Lord. So, Carol, God bless you.
Thank you. Well, I'm quite pleased to see all of you that have come out, and I'm under no illusions. I know you're here for the pork chops, not for me, but they were great. It was a great meal. And when John asked me to speak, I thought, really, there must be a mistake, because I should be sitting where you're sitting, and you should be up here. When I look at the collective wisdom gathered in this room, I would just love to sit down and talk with each one of you, because I'm sure you could teach me many things. As I was preparing this talk, I began to wonder, well, when does my story really begin? I don't have the classic Christian testimony with a before and an after segment. Instead, I can see that God was at work as a steady constant throughout my life. In fact, I'm beginning to see his influence even long before I was born. My brother has recently been working on our family history and has worked his way back to 1692 in Salem, Massachusetts. For those of you who are history buffs, you might be thinking, isn't that around the time of the Salem witch trials? You may chuckle, but actually that is correct. I would never have imagined that I am related to one of the women who is front and center of this drama. And this is what I've recently discovered in the archives about my ancestor, Mary Esty. Mary Esty was about 58 years old and was married to Isaac Esty, with whom she had had 11 children. They owned and lived on a large farm. Mary was well respected in Salem. She was a kind, religious woman whose dignified demeanor fit the strict Puritan mold. But even she was not safe from the hysteria. In April 1692, she was accused of witchcraft. The accusation shocked the village. Unlike some of the other alleged witches, she was not a social outcast or an outspoken woman who may have offended the villagers. Perhaps the accusation was inspired by envy. The Esties owned a valuable farm in Salem. Or maybe Mary was a likely target after the conviction of her sister, Rebecca Nurse. Mary was calm and respectful during her examination, but the afflicted girl's cries were insistent, and Mary was sent to prison. She was set free a few days later, but one of the young girls cried out that Esty's apparition was strangling her. Her fit was so severe that Mary was put back into jail. On September 9th, Mary Esty was tried and condemned, despite her plea. And I quote, she said, "I never complied, but prayed against Satan all my days. I will say it, if it was my last time, I am clear of this sin." Before her execution, she wrote a letter to the judges. In it, she said, "The Lord above knows my innocency. I petition your honors, not for my own life. I know I must die, and my appointed time is set. If it be possible, I humbly plead that no more innocent blood be shed." Her letter raised sympathy and doubt in Salem Village, but could not prevent the last round of hangings. Esty and seven others were carted to Gallows Hill on September 22nd. John Caleb described the scene. Mary Esty, when she took her last farewell of her husband, children, and friends, was, as is reported by them present, as serious religious, distinct, and affectionate as could well be expressed, drawing tears from the eyes of almost all present. This story rocked my world. However, the saga did not end at Gallows Hill. 2 months after the hanging, Mary's accuser recanted, saying that Mary was indeed innocent. But it was not until 19 years later that Mary's family was compensated for the wrongful conviction with a payment of £20. I could not imagine what grief and anguish that family must have gone through to witness the execution of their dear wife and mother. What I hadn't considered, though, was the experience of the jurors. My brother recently uncovered a letter that was written by William Fisk, one of the jurors that sentenced Mary to her death. And here is a brief excerpt from his letter. And he speaks on behalf of all the jurors. "We fear we have been instrumental with others, though ignorantly and unwittingly, to bring upon ourselves and this people of the Lord the guilt of innocent blood, which sin the Lord saith in Scripture he would not pardon. We do therefore hereby signify our deep sense of and sorrow for our errors in acting on such evidence to the condemning of any person, and do hereby declare that we justly fear that we were sadly deluded and mistaken, for which we are much disquieted and distressed in our minds, and do therefore humbly beg forgiveness. First of God, for Christ's sake, for this our error, we do hereby ask forgiveness of you all, whom we have justly offended, and do declare, according to our present minds, we would none of us do such things again." This was an honest and humble recognition of guilt and a pleading for forgiveness. However, even with this letter, one could conjecture that this church and community would have been torn apart by the dramatic turn of events. If this were a novel, one could logically expect that this would be the beginning of a centuries-long feud between the families of the victims and those on the juries. However, this does not seem to be the case. My brother and I surmised that there must have been a beautiful spirit of love and forgiveness between those families. For two generations later, the granddaughter of the juror that wrote the letter married the grandson of Mary Esty. Talk about redemption. So what does this revelation teach me? I have been wronged in my life, certainly not as dramatically as Mary Esty, but painful nonetheless. I tried to forgive, but I had great difficulty letting go of those feelings of bitterness and resentment that hang on with a tentacle-like grip. I've always been challenged by Jesus' words on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I now feel responsible and compelled to ask God to give me the grace and strength I need to really love and forgive those that have caused me pain. I know that you weren't expecting my story to begin back in 1692, but I know that many of the narratives in the Bible begin with a list of who one's ancestors are. And because this story is so new to me, I'm still processing what it all means. But now I'm going to jump ahead a few centuries and give you some virtual snapshots of some more of the branches of my family tree from around the world. I'm not a technology whiz like my husband, so I don't have a PowerPoint presentation with pictures, but I thought you all have good imaginations, so these will be the kind of snapshots we'll have. So in the first picture, you will see a tall, strapping lad of 16 kissing his mother goodbye in Sweden as he hops on a boat to America where he will begin a new life. Gustav Peterson, who is my great-grandfather, started out in Minnesota with a lot of other Swedes and then took the long trek up to Saskatchewan, where he started a homestead in Mydale. My maternal grandmother was born on the farm at Mydale, and it was here that she met my grandfather, Esty McDowell, whose family had moved to Saskatchewan, also hoping to find a better life. As you may have guessed, my grandfather, Esty, was the descendant of Mary Esty. I remember him as a kind and gentle man. We will now move over to my father's side of the family tree. So the next picture you need in your mind is of my paternal grandfather, who was in the British cavalry in India. Caleb Fisher has worked his way up the ranks of the military as far as he can go. He has just been told that there is no hope of further promotions because he is from the lower working class back in England. He too leaves his homeland and travels to Saskatchewan to homestead at Lipton. My father was born on that farm at Lipton. A few weeks after my father's birth, my grandfather headed overseas to serve with the Canadian military in World War I. He was gone for the first 3 years of my father's life. During that time, my grandmother and her sister ran the farm and also looked after the two young boys. The next picture will show my paternal grandmother, Grace, also arriving in the Lipton area a few years earlier with her parents and 11 brothers and sisters. Her father had been a law clerk in England and saw the possibility of homesteading as a way of providing opportunity for the family. Unfortunately, he died of pneumonia shortly after arriving in Canada, but as was common in those days, the older children left home to find work so that they could send money home to support the family. So what do I learn from these stories? I see willingness to take risks, to leave the familiar behind, even when you don't know exactly what the future holds. I see a huge sense of responsibility to care for one's family, even when it involves hard work and not much financial reward. I see a sense of duty to serve one's country. I see how I have reaped the rewards of their sacrifices, and I'm thankful. And now we'll move on to the next generation. My father went to the country school in the Lipton area as far as grade 8, for that was all that was offered at this time. He had a real thirst for learning and so took the rest of his schooling by correspondence so that he could get his grade 12. He went on to normal school in Regina and taught in several small country schools. It was in Creelman, where he was the principal, that he met my mother, who was the primary school teacher. They married and he taught for a few more years until he felt a call to the ministry in United Church. They had some lean years while he was studying at St. Andrew's College in Saskatoon. He commuted back and forth by bus each week to Hanley, where he carried a full load as a minister so that he could support his family. We lived in manses in various small towns throughout Saskatchewan. As was the policy at that time, the church owned the manse and all of the furniture in it. This was our home, but it was also my dad's workplace. The upside of all of this was that because my father had his study in our home, we likely saw a lot more of our dad than many of other children. He would work on his sermons there and meet with people to plan weddings or funerals. I loved to swoop into his study just after a prospective bride and groom had left because I could catch the lovely lingering scent of the bride's perfume. On the other hand, I also remember that you could feel the weight at the collective grief and sadness as a family would come in to plan a funeral. We were very aware of the realities of life, the joy of young love, and the sorrow of sickness and death. And we saw that God was very much a part of all of this. My mother was a stay-at-home mom for most of that time. I remember when she started taking correspondence classes and going to summer schools so that she could upgrade her teaching certificate and return to the classroom. She started back teaching when I was 13. She was asked to start a special education classroom. It was a big challenge, but she gave it her all and involved the community as well. She organized work placements so that they could learn life skills. She taught her students to cook and sew, as well as academic subjects. It was an enormous task that she set for herself, but she was loved and respected by the whole community. My mother taught me to see her students as God sees them. She showed me that if you look for the good in people, you will find it. Town kids always walked home for lunch. I was the youngest child in our family, and so when I was in high school, I had my dad all to myself for those lunch hours. He would often spend his mornings working on his sermon, so we would discuss what he had been learning. It wasn't a lecture. It was a time of sharing the joy of discovering treasures in the Bible. Other times, he would talk about someone he had visited in the hospital and the struggle that they were having. These were rich times, and ones that I still treasure. I took my first year of university in Saskatoon. This was the era of the Jesus people. I don't know if you've heard of them. Anyway, I remember seeing a poster on campus for something called a Jesus party. Well, I thought that sounded interesting, and wow, it was more than interesting. Picture hippies in praise the Lord mode. It was a shock to my system, but it drew me in because it was people of my age with a vibrant faith that was very much alive and real. I began attending their Jesus parties, which were really just praise and worship times, regularly. That summer I needed a place to stay while I worked in Saskatoon, so I moved in with some of the girls from that group. The leaders of the group had no Bible school training. In fact, they were draft dodgers from the States. This all added to the intrigue. However, over the course of the summer, I was becoming more and more uneasy with their leadership. They were quick to criticize and condemn any other Christian denomination or style of worship. They were the only pure Christians. This way of thinking was completely foreign to me, for my dad had always worked very cooperatively with other denominations and taught us to find the good in each one. The final straw for me came the day that one of the leaders had a meeting with me. He told me that they needed to purify the group. They had discovered that I had been baptized as an infant, and I needed to be baptized right away, or I'd have to leave because I would be contaminating the group. Well, I didn't need to be told to go. I was very ready to leave. Looking back, I would say that even though this experience was difficult, it was also transformative. Although it had been an unfortunate ending, these people had lit a spark in me. I had been coasting along spiritually up until then, and this forced me to question and make my faith my own. I went on to university in Toronto that fall. Thankfully, I was accepted into the second year of the degree program in occupational therapy. Toronto was a huge shift from small town Saskatchewan. Soon after I arrived, I walked around the campus trying to figure out where my classes would be. I remember on that day several people asked me if I was lost. I hadn't thought that it was that obvious. However, God was there ahead of me. On that exploratory walk, I met one of my classmates who was also feeling just as bewildered as I was. Together, we figured things out, and it turned out that this new friend, Linda, was from a Mennonite family that lives outside of Kitchener. We hit it off right away. We were both missing our families and trying to survive on very limited funds. We became close friends and roommates. We had much more in common with each other than many of the wealthy girls from Toronto who were in our class. I remember one day after classes, some of our classmates decided to go out for lunch to a nice seafood restaurant. Linda and I looked at each other because we knew that would be totally out of our league financially. But not to be outdone, we scooted over to the nearest Woolworths counter and split an order of fish and chips to reduce the cost of what was already a bargain meal. We laughed together and thoroughly enjoyed our treat. Linda's family became my family. We went to her home on many weekends and school holidays. I learned a lot about the Mennonites and really learned to appreciate their generosity and their faithful walk. One summer during university, I couldn't find a job, and so my uncle in Northern Ontario offered me work. I lived with them, and I would do whatever needed doing, whether it was painting, pouring cement, or gardening. I loved my aunt and uncle, and so really appreciated this time, this chance to spend time with them, as well as to earn some money. At the end of the summer, my uncle graciously offered to buy me a ticket so that I could fly home to see my parents before classes started in the fall. I was thrilled because I hadn't seen my parents since Christmas. Unfortunately, on my trip home, my purse was stolen in the airport with all of the money that I had earned that summer. I told my parents the night that I arrived home, and we discussed how I could possibly find a way to pay for the next semester. My course load at university was very full, so a part-time job was not an option. I'm still in awe of God's timing and provision. The very next day, my dad came home from the post office with a very important-looking letter for me. I opened it and discovered that I had been given a bursary from the Saskatchewan Department of Health to help pay for my education. God is so good. Amen. After graduation, I returned to Regina to work because I had to work in Saskatchewan for 3 years to pay back my bursary. That was 39 years ago, so I think I've paid back my debt by now. I've been privileged to work at every hospital in Regina, including the one that's no longer here. I've worked at Wascana Rehab Center, home care many times, two nursing homes, and palliative care for 13 years. I've met the most incredible people and seen the challenges that they have faced and worked to overcome. I've seen faith in adversity. They have taught me to be grateful for all of the blessings in my life. And speaking of blessings, it was in Regina that I met Merv Hefting. In our first conversation, we discovered that he grew up on a farm 3 miles down the road from the farm where my dad had lived. His mom delivered eggs to my grandma, and Merv rode on the same school bus as all of my cousins. I couldn't help but fall in love with him. And we were married in this church 33 years ago. There have been struggles, but God has seen us through. And looking back, it's often in those difficult times that we cling to God and our faith is strengthened. One of those difficult years was when I was pregnant with our first child. I'd been quite sick during the pregnancy, but needed to keep working because of our financial need. One day I was in terrible pain, so I drove to the hospital. I discovered that I needed to have my appendix out immediately. I remember asking the doctor, well, what about the baby? And he replied, well, you won't be much good if the baby dead. Well, that was a sobering thought and helped to make the decision right on the spot. I really appreciate the prayers of the people of this church during that time. Both baby and I survived the surgery. The beautiful provision of the Lord in all of this was that because of the surgery, I was able to take some sick time to rest and recover. And that helped to prepare me for the next challenge. Shortly after that, Merv's accountant came to him to confess that he had been stealing money from Merv's business. 1 month before our baby was to be born, Merv had to declare bankruptcy. This was devastating news. I'd hoped to be able to stay at home with the baby, but that was not to be. I needed to return to work when our daughter was 6 months old. The room that we had prepared for our baby in our little 500 square foot house needed to be changed into Merv's office. A big typesetting machine was moved in, and Merv began to build up a clientele so that he could begin to work from our home. But the upside of all of this was that because we had a small house, it also meant that we had a small mortgage. I was able to support our family on half-time wages. That was a blessing. Merv gradually began to rebuild his new business so that he could start paying himself a wage. That was a relief because I soon became pregnant again with our second child. We moved into a little bigger house, and 2 years after that, we had our third child. All through those years of raising children, I worked the minimal amount of hours so that I could maintain my professional registration, but be at home with our children as much as possible. I love being a mom. Our three children have been a great blessing. They've all grown up to love and serve the Lord. That has been my prayer and continues to be my prayer. I'm thankful for a godly heritage and hope and pray that my children will carry the faith on to the next generation. You may wonder why I included so much about my grandparents and those that came long before me. That's because I feel they helped to shape me, just as you have helped to shape your children and grandchildren. I cannot emphasize too much the value of praying grandparents. I know that grandparents' prayers have had an impact both on me and my children. I remember when my grandfather was in his 80s and one of his friends said to him, Charlie, why do you still go to church every Sunday? You know you're deaf as a post. You can't hear a word, the minister said. To this, my grandfather replied, I want my children to know it's important to go to church. They say that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, I would add, it takes a family, and also a church family. I remember when I would pick up my children from the church nursery, right here in this basement, I would catch the sweet lingering scent on their little heads where they had been held and caressed by some dear soul, and the perfume had rubbed off onto their heads. I was so grateful for those influences in their lives, which allowed me to attend church while they cared for them during the church service. And I would like to encourage you all right now. There are children that need your prayers. They may be your grandchildren or children that have no one to pray for them. I know that there are many people in this congregation that bring their grandchildren to church. Good for you. I often see some of you talking to young people that visit this church. Thank you for taking the time to show them that they have value both to us and to God. So as a church family, we see your faithfulness. You are wonderful examples to those that follow. May God bless each one of you. Thank you.